Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy Torian Thompson is still not committed to a school day.
Nope. And I have a
feeling. I guess that's been every day for all time. It's pretty much
years.
There's never been a day where Torian Thompson has been committed to a school in the history of the universe. So, really, it's just another day in our lives here. At Troy Noons is an Absolute Broadcast.
Yeah, I think we should just stop holding our breath. Not that I don't think he's going to come, because I honestly think he's going to. I just don't think it's worth sitting around and waiting and counting down. It's more just, let's just go about our lives as we have been for 18 years. And the day that he decides to commit to Syracuse, we all rejoice. We get excited that we don't have the same depth issues anymore, and then, you know, we just move on with him as a member of the team.
It's just funny because, like, Syracuse wants him. It sounds like he wants Syracuse. Seton Hall doesn't seem to have a spot available.
No.
And Michigan State is, like, the third team that doesn't generate any talk whatsoever, which, like, in, you know, if you're a pessimist, you can argue maybe that, like, scares you away and makes you think that they're, like, the wild card here, but it's just, like, bizarre how little they're discussed, even though, did he visit there recently or he was done a visit there? I don't even know anymore. It's like, his recruitment just seems to never end. But yeah, I think it's hard to even, like, get worked up at this point because it's just, I joked on Twitter, like, after the last update, it's like, I think he's just going to, like, show up on our team one day and, like, they're going to, the first practice, someone's going to be like, oh, Tarina Thompson's on the team, I guess.
Oh, hey, guys, gonna. Now that there was that Mike Waters post from a couple of days ago that was talking about Eric Williams, same deal. Just, you know, just decided a week before class started, hey, I'm here. And then and then he ended up leaving anyway.
That's yeah, I guess stranger things have happened, so we'll see. If we get him, it's a nice ad. If not, I think the team, you know, it has some issues, but it'll we'll survive. Syracuse basketball will go on.
Yeah, and I think that's what I'm seeing both camps, I'm sure you are too, that there's two very different schools of thought. There's the, at this point, SU basketball is a well-oiled machine. Even if there's depth issues, they've been able to conquer those before, they'll be fine. Or the, if we don't get Thompson, you know, we're basically going to be trotting out walk-ons nonsense that, you know, I think if last year did nothing, it should have at least confirmed to anyone that the program's in good hands. It can run itself in many regards, and this is not a program anymore that is going to be taking, you know, monumental steps back. I mean, obviously, we're only 2 years removed from what was a pretty bad season in Rocky and Christmas's final year, but I think this year kind of reestablished the order of things and even helped us take a leap forward as a program. In that, you know, We didn't underachieve during the regular season. I think we took our lumps. I think we learned from them. And then a senior-led team, you know, was able to get itself to the Final Four. I think this year, maybe not the senior-led part, but I think that you have enough experience on the roster that, you know, even with some depth issues, I mean, these are young kids. Stamina is not going to be a major, major problem. That these guys will be just fine.
Yeah, and Jim Boeheim's so loath to go beyond seven when he can avoid it, even when you'd think that maybe the team does warrant it, that I think, add in the zone and everything else, I think Syracuse teams are generally a little more equipped to handle less depth, although obviously I'd rather have the four-star power forward who everyone really likes in addition to the team we already have. So, you know, fingers crossed, everyone.
Very much agreed. Is moving a little bit past basketball into football. Dan, an idea we've been kind of batting around the block the last couple days, not realigning the ACC football divisions because that's a tired idea, but just completely getting rid of them. This is something that we talked about many times before, but, you know, SB Nation kind of jumped in earnest on the SEC on Tuesday and then the Big Ten on Wednesday. We kind of took a cue to check out the ACC, based on the proposal at least. You know, are there any glaring issues in the second iteration? I know today I kind of did some schedule balancing that seemed to get, you know, a lot more fans than yesterday's version.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting idea. I guess there are obvious challenges with it, but I think with the ACC, ended with the SEC a little, you know, maybe a little less so. Just divisions are always going to present the issue of potential over unbalancing. Obviously, in the ACC, it's happened in a big way because Clemson and Florida State are the clear two best programs in the conference, and they are stuck on the same side. Obviously, things were planned out differently. They, you know, Clemson emerged. Miami never really got off the ground after moving to the ACC, which was pretty much aligned to get Miami-Florida State title games if possible. And that's obviously never happened because Miami, the 1 year they tied for the Coastal, they were not eligible for postseason play. So, yeah, this gets rid of all those issues. Even if you realign the divisions and shuffle the, you know, shuffle things a little bit, you never know when some other team emerges as a powerhouse and then, you know, another dives into the basement for an extended period of time, and you might still have the same issues even after changing. So I like the idea. Obviously, there has to be I know the Big 12 is looking at a championship game with 10, so I guess that's contingent on the NCAA changing that arbitrary rule. But if you could change it so there can still be a championship game, which is obviously a big revenue driver, and then have those protected rivalries. I know you introduced like the proposal with three per team, even if it's just, you know, specific rivalries, and we don't protect like a Syracuse Pitt game. I know that's how like the Pac-12 does it, and I think that works out pretty well. Obviously, they have divisions as well, but they manage to kind of keep everything they need on the schedule intact. So I like the idea. Obviously, there's no like perfect solution, but making it so that the conference doesn't feel like two very separate things, which it does now when you only play a team every 6 years and you only host a team every 12 years if they're not your crossover or in your division. I just think that's such a bad, it doesn't make any sense for teams that are supposed to be in the same league. And if you can fix that in any way, whether it's pods or whether it's your proposal or a similar proposal, I think that's a step up in the right direction.
Yeah, and you know, I think, you know, I addressed this on the Tuesday article. Each league kind of has its own characteristics around realignment and how it's dealt with it since. I think that while, you know, the Maryland and Rutgers additions were weird for the Big Ten, the jump to a 9-game conference schedule, the fact that they do face a lot of these traditional powerhouses has allowed them to, at least on Maryland's front, I feel, become more integrated quicker. I think that the fact that they still have 11 core members who have been there for a very long time, 10 who have been there even longer, and then Nebraska being a traditional powerhouse, I feel like it was a natural fit there, from the beginning. I think that you're looking at a much more cogent identity. I think the Pac-10, same deal. You're looking at 10 teams who've been together since the Arizona schools joined in the late 70s. And then since then, you know, only the two additions in Colorado and Utah, both of whom I think fit right in at this point. You're not really questioning it. SEC is the same deal again, only adding four teams in the last 25 years. And I think most people forget that South Carolina and Arkansas were ever anywhere else. And then the fact that A&M and Missouri have respectively been successful in the SEC, you know, really helps that integration process, even if they're stuck with an 8-game conference schedule like the ACC, and it doesn't really lend to as many repeat games. The ACC, you know, again, as I mentioned, much different scenario. We're an 8-team league for a long time, became a 9-team league only in the early 90s. Florida State, and then since then have lost one program in Maryland and added six. So almost half the league is a fairly recent addition. Many of them a recent addition from the same conference, so there's carryover rivalries there or the gaps in time have kind of, you know, removed senses of rivalry. There's just, it's tailor-made. This, you know, protect three rivals concept works really well for the SEC because they have so many rivals, but it also drops off a few important ones. With the ACC, you don't lose a single important rival, but if anything, you end up forcing a couple, which to me is actually the lesser of two evils. But it does, however, force this kind of, collective culture and identity that I feel is just currently lacking in the ACC.
Right, and the ACC for so long, it just seems like they've been just following exactly what the SEC's done down to the 8-game schedule. So now that we see that the ACC might be ahead of the SEC and moving to the 9 games, which I know presents Syracuse some particular issues with scheduling, but I think overall is probably better for the same, you know, conference identity issues. is interesting because it makes it seem like they're a little bit more of their own animal now.
Agreed. And I think, you know, where the Pac-12 kind of runs laps around everybody else is they had the nine-game schedule idea before anybody else. I feel like those teams are very quick to, you know, wrap up future schedules. I feel like they have no problem grabbing future dates. I mean, especially when you have basically one conference out there in the Mountain West that can easily, you know, hop into one of those out-of-conference slots every year, and then an FCS team for almost all of them that grabs another. You know, then that last one is usually just filled by, you know, any Big Ten or Big 12 school particularly that wants to fill it. But where the Pac-12 really has an advantage over the other three, you know, divisional power conference leagues, is how linear all the numbers are. I mean, you have those two protected rivalries with the California schools, but it works a lot easier because it's all multiples of three. You know, you're looking at 6 teams per division, you're looking at 9 conference games. Everything kind of moves along an easy line. With 14 is obviously just, I think when all this realignment crap started, I don't think anyone was ever sitting around going, all right, 14 is the number, because the number, it doesn't line up, it doesn't match. There's a lot wrong with the number just in terms of, you know, how you can create a balanced and easy to digest schedule. And I think that's really why this three pod system, which I would say probably is the brainchild of Brian Favett from BC Interruption. I know David Thiel over at the Daily Press wrote about it too, but my earliest recollection of it was probably about 3 or 4 years ago from Brian.
Yeah, I mean, the pod, I think people have like mocked a little bit, but I just think you want to keep specific things together. And obviously the ACC has, you know, you have the triangle schools all need to play each other. And then I'm sure, like, if Wake Forest could play those schools, they would, although they seem to get the shortchanged out of the four. And then you have the UNC-Virginia rivalry. You have Clemson-Georgia Tech. You have everyone wanting to play in Atlanta and Florida, Miami-Florida State. So there's just a lot of overlapping interests. So just freeing up fewer unnecessary annual games, like, you know, a Syracuse Pitt, which might end up getting protected anyway, or, you know, a Syracuse NC State, or, you know, Boston College, Florida State. Like, does that have, like, a weird...
No.
Yeah, just games that just, like, that's fine. Like, I get why they're there now, but if that's not a game every single year, no one's going to care, and in 5 years they'll forget that was a game every year. So I just hope they find a way to do that. And obviously in college football, they'll probably find the most asinine half measure to fix it. And, you know, we'll just have to settle for that.
Yeah, unfortunately, I have to agree with you. I mean, and not that I'm, you know, tooting my own horn. Again, I'm not the person that came up with this idea to begin with, but I think that I've put together probably the most complete solution so far. For the ACC with this three permanent rivals setup. I mean, like you said, we don't want to play Pitt every year. It hasn't been advantageous to us in ever. But at the same time, if we're going to be protecting Pitt in the current setup makes zero sense. Protecting Pitt in this setup probably makes a lot of sense. Louisville, on the other hand, is more of a toss-up. You don't have to have them in there, and I think I mentioned that a bunch too. Like, where the ACC excels here is that, you know, you have a lot more flexibility. There's really not a whole lot of sacred cows that get, you know, put out here. I think the only game that really, you know, stands out as missing is probably the UNC-Wake Forest game is the only one that really gets the shaft out of the, you know, quote-unquote rivalries that this conference possesses currently anyway.
Right, and that's part of the reason why I think we end up missing out on, like how cool would it, I mean... I think part of the reason why a lot of people thought the ACC was a cool move on top of the obvious, like, it needed to happen, but we were getting back together with schools like Virginia Tech and Miami, and obviously we play Virginia Tech this year, but that's going to be the first time we've played either of those two teams, and I don't even know when we have Miami coming around. But
next year.
It's just, okay, next year, and then we have to wait for 5 and 6 years, respectively. So just very disjointed on that end, as much as I enjoy playing Wake Forest every year and getting that win. If we have to sacrifice the biannual trips to Winston-Salem, I think we'll get over it.
4-game win streak. Going back to that stupid game that we should have lost and then we won.
Forgot about that.
I did not forget about that. I was
losing. I was at that game. I've been at all of those games, actually. I've been at all 4 of those.
Oof.
I picked good football games to go to, everyone.
I mean, at least you're traveling lesser distances to see them than I am.
I mean, I get less than you. It's still North Carolina.
Fair. I guess, Dan, what do you think the ACC will do? I mean, I think we can probably take the logical plan, this one, off the table as something that will happen. Do you think that 9 games is a likely solution? Do you think if Jim Delaney stops being a troll that maybe we can get rid of divisions? I know he was one of the main detractors from that plan. Do you think we're looking at divisional realignment, or do you think we're just going to sit here and watch the status quo and see Clemson and Florida State battle it out for a de facto championship every regular season?
I think the next move will be 9, and then maybe after another team gets emboldened and maybe makes a bigger move, then the ACC follows suit. But I still think I don't think the ACC is going to go out on the ledge and be the first ones to do something kind of, you know, off the cuff. So I do think eventually they'll go to 9 games, and that'll help a little bit. That'll, you know, change. That'll move stuff from, what, every 6 years to every 3 years, which is better. And it's a start. But I think eventually, you know, another one of the leads will probably step up and be like, all right, this division stuff's stupid. Maybe the Big 12, if they actually do add teams and decide they don't want the same issues that they had when they had 2 divisions with the really unbalanced league setup that they were dealing with. So I don't expect the ACC to be a leader here. Yeah, I don't think they'll be the ones to go out on the limb. But if someone else does, which I don't know, like the Pac-12 is the obvious one, but I don't think they need to. Maybe the Big Ten, because they have a ton of divisional issues that are hard to solve. And right now they have a very unbalanced East with Michigan kind of coming along as fast as it did. We'll see. I think it'll probably go to a 9-game schedule before anything else, and that is the easiest solution for them. And then maybe down the road we'll see something a little more drastic.
That's fair. And honestly, like, I think it's weird that the ACC, considering, I think they're trailblazing in terms of realignment, but I feel like they have been a first mover there. I feel like at the end of the day, you only lost Maryland. Maryland pretty much had to go no matter what the ACC could do for them. But I don't really consider that much of a loss. And at the end of the day, we traded them for Louisville, so net win on the ACC's front. But it is weird that the ACC takes every other cue from the SEC and in another breath, Notre Dame, really, when it comes to doing anything, they're kind of, you know, waiting for two other rocks to move before they do anything at all.
Yep, I mean, that's just where we are. Like we said to start, maybe, you know, going to 9 games before the SEC makes a move there is a sign of things to come. Maybe the news of potentially, but not necessarily, impending ACC network that people can't seem to agree on, maybe that means that the league's getting a little more bold as well. Who knows?
Yeah.
We've been hearing about that for like 3 years, and it seems like people are now deciding that that's happening, except for a couple non-ACC. I think, I forget who said it wasn't going to happen, but it wasn't anyone important. But then a bunch of like people closer to the conference said that it's like going to happen very soon, or going to happen in the next 3 years, or Notre Dame might be coming soon, and you know, maybe they'll do it without Notre Dame. So like, there's so much noise around that network, but it does seem like the trend is that it is going to be a reality, which is good.
Yeah, and I mean, you look at the, and not that this is the end-all be-all anymore, but, you know, when realignment first started going, the last round, it was all about TV markets and all about footprint. I think things have changed with cord-cutting and ESPN dropping subscribers like flies. There's a lot wrong with, you know, that way of thinking just a couple years ago. But I think what you're still seeing for the ACC, however, is that there's a large potential footprint, you know, all along the Eastern Seaboard and some growing markets like Louisville, you know, Notre Dame, Red, Chicago. There's a lot that says more than half the country's population is a subscriber very quickly. And you look at what the Big Ten did. Yes, there was some pushback at the beginning, but despite the fact that Rutgers does not do anything to move the needle in New York, and Maryland barely moves the needle in D.C., having those markets, as local options that some fans would want, or even the idea that some fans would want, was enough to get the Big Ten network picked up pretty much everywhere at this point. SEC obviously has, its own, easier path because of the national brands that it plays with. I think that the ACC's demographics really help it out a lot. I do think we're 3 years out, but I'm also in the camp of a lot of other folks who have said, this isn't going to be a traditional network. And that might disappoint some people, but I think those people will come around quickly when they see that, the ACC, which has been, quietly, slowly investing more in mobile and digital properties, like, I feel like that's probably where this network is not only headed but better suited for long term, and that might mean a dip from the revenues people think we'd be getting from a network, but in reality those projections people might have in their heads were never really viable to begin with.
Yeah, I think there's a fair chance that the network that rolls out is like you said, it's more of a cord cutting type, not like traditional network like you have in the SEC and the Big Ten, but there's also a good chance that networks like that wind up having to move towards more of the model that the ACC network might begin to be, just based on people, losing subscribers, which it's been a huge issue for ESPN. And while the SEC network and the Big Ten network have both been big successes, the Pac-12 network is a total debacle, and that's a lead that we've spent half, the first 20 minutes of this podcast praising. They do almost everything right, and their network launch is hilariously bad, which people don't realize just as it doesn't get talked about a lot out here. And then the Longhorn Network, which obviously, apples and oranges, it's not a conference network, but it's both handicapping the Big 12 in a big way, and as a network on its own, it's not very successful either. So it has its own issues. So if the ACC launches a network that's not quite as powerful as the Big 10 or SEC right away, there's still a good chance it's going to be the third most successful and at least more sustainable than what the Big 12 and Pac-12 are dealing with, especially considering like ESPN's not going to want to take a huge risk on things, so they might just roll something out that's is guaranteed to be a modest, if not like absolute home run success.
Agreed. You know what? I'm happy to play the long game on this because, like you said too, if everyone has to transition to what an ACC, a digital mobile first kind of ACC network could be, I think I'd be fine to wait it out there. I have a feeling that a lot of these large deals aren't going to see themselves to the end. I think there's going to be not necessarily consolidation. I actually think we might see less consolidation, but it's going to be kind of, you're going to see a lot of networks and a lot of sports kind of jumping into, niche options, and I mean, look at what like Conference USA is losing a ton of money on their TV deal, but exposure wise, because it's a short term deal that they're going for, they might be hedging their bets for the future, and I think it might actually pay off. I know we said this about the programs they added as well during realignment, and that doesn't really seem like it's worked, and most people couldn't probably name more than five programs in that conference, but I think that model, albeit with some better networks perhaps, could potentially be the best bet 10 years down the road.
Yeah, and it's also like the ACC, it hasn't been like the football power maybe ever. And obviously it was named along with the Big 12 and still is to a point as like the power conference that's most, easily targeted by the others. But it's kind of done what the leadership's done what it's needed to do to stay alive and continue to be viable and hold off, any major issues. I mean, losing Maryland is one thing, but like you said before, I think adding Louisville was at worst a wash, at best like a pretty solid upgrade, especially in terms of how those athletic departments are managed. So the ACC's been very good at like keeping itself alive and keeping itself, relatively strong and staying a viable member of the Power Five, and getting a network, even if it's not, going to be in every home right away or the powerhouse that the other two major networks are. As long as it keeps the ACC, a decent amount ahead of the curve and you know, strong enough to where teams are happy in the league and the league is content with where it is, I think there's a lot for us to worry about. And also the Brand of Rights is huge. Keeping the Brand of Rights and sending that when the time comes is totally necessary. But I'm not too worried about that because that still has another 9 years or so.
Yeah, I think the worry about the Grant of Rights probably doesn't even come into play until, I don't know, 5, maybe 4 years out. You're probably looking at 2020-ish, 2021, before people really start talking about that for every league. Big Ten's purposely put itself on a different timeline so that it can swipe schools at the end, potentially, and then renegotiate with a larger footprint.
And then the SEC doesn't have one because it's power moves only.
I mean, it's a bold strategy. I don't... The SEC can't lose anybody at the moment, but I
mean, I just don't know. It won't. Like, there's no one's going to leave the SEC. Like, it's totally fine with them not having one.
Yeah. Although I do think that there's only one possibility here, and I feel like it's the insane possibility of Texas and Oklahoma to the Big Ten, and then Kansas, and then Missouri has to go.
Yeah, I mean, that would be, you know, Mizzou going after the girl that it tried to go after for, like, 3 years straight, and then didn't, and then went with another girl, and then's like, I'm going back to option one.
I agree, but...
Even if there's nothing wrong with you.
but
this has been really good for both of us. It's worked out probably better for you than you thought. But there's this thing that I was thinking about before.
It's worth like three times. That's the problem, too, is like the SEC is obviously great. And I think the Big Ten football product is top heavy. But if that league was able to add Oklahoma, Texas, Missouri, and Kansas, the value of membership in that league is worth leaving the SEC for.
It's possible. And, you know, getting the Kansas-Missouri thing back would be good. And I don't think Kansas will ever be in the SEC for obvious reasons. But you're obviously then asking the Texas to fold its network, and that just doesn't seem to... Like, Texas is holding this entire thing up, and it's kind of hilarious and probably good for the ACC, honestly, in, like, a backwards way. But it's just really funny to watch this one team that hasn't even been good in a while, just totally screw up the plans of probably like two or three other leagues. And like countless other teams.
You know, like 30 programs.
Yeah, legitimately. Like every other program in their state, really every other program in the Big 12, like it directly affects. And then the Pac-12 probably would have had them if not for the Longhorn Network. The Big 10 could make a move if not for the Longhorn Network. The ACC, SEC would obviously both make overtures. Like, it's really funny.
I still kind of want to see Texas being independent, because they can do it.
That'd be something. Well, that'd be such a Texas move.
But like A&M almost did it a couple of years ago too. Like when they were thinking about leaving the SEC, if the SEC wasn't interested, A&M was interested in just going independent. Now
I think that was more posturing. I think that was like they probably thought maybe they had stepped out too far from the Big 12, and they were just saying, you know, well, if the SEC doesn't work out, we'll just do this anyway. But I don't ever see them. I don't think they were in a good enough place at the time.
Right.
I don't think now, Texas probably could do it.
Texas could easily do it because everyone would want a piece of, you know, national pickup on the Longhorn Network, Texas recruit access. I mean, you look at Texas's non-conference scheduling, and teams flock to Texas. I think that Texas is one of maybe a handful of programs that could go independent along with USC, Florida, Alabama, and Ohio State,
Michigan probably could.
Ohio State and Michigan, that's probably the list.
And Texas is what I actually like, and this, you know, this is not happening, by the way, anyone listening. The Texas makes the most sense out of all of those because Texas would leave and all the Big 12 programs would lose their minds. And then Texas would be like, hey, you guys want to play? And then their entire schedule would just look like half a Big 12 schedule. And it would be great.
It would be like a much, much more lucrative, larger version of what BYU did to the Mountain West.
Yeah, pretty much. You just see like Texas Tech and like Oklahoma and Oklahoma State would be like putting out all these like nasty statements, especially Oklahoma. Oklahoma would be so loud.
Oh, gosh.
And then they would ditch for the Pac-12 like in a second. But and then Tetsu would be like, yo, you guys still want to do the Red River thing? And Norton was like, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
100%, yeah, for sure.
All about it.
All right. So why don't we talk some beer before we jump into the Mountain West, since I feel like there's a lot to talk about, and I feel like nobody's really, at least in your part of the country, no one talks about the Mountain West because it's on too late and on channels nobody has.
No, I think more about the MAC and the Sun Belt than I do about the Mountain West, which isn't fair because that's a much better league. But it's just like, you know, I don't get the like random Wednesday night exposure to it.
Fair enough. Dan, what have you been drinking?
A bunch of like normal standbys, some all-day IPA, some Dales, some, I got over to Dinosaur, so I had their Ape Hanger, which is good. I'd say that the newer stuff that I've had, I talked about the Evil Twin last week. I tried Sierra Nevada's Otra Vez, which is it's a dose, I believe.
Yeah.
Really nice. I hadn't had that before. And it's kind of outside their like normal stuff, which is obviously like hoppier and more, you know, traditional West Coast like IPA stuff. So this was a really strong effort. And obviously doses are really, really big right now, which is very obvious as everyone's brewing one. But this was really strong, so I enjoyed that. And I had, I was at the bar by us that we go to a lot happens to be a Cleveland bar. So we were there watching the Cavs Warriors game, sorry, the other night, the one the Cavs won.
Someone just shot himself in the face.
so sorry. and they have a couple of Cleveland beers. So I had a Citra Dog from Thirsty Dog Brewing, which I believe is a Cleveland brewery. And that was an IPA, and that was pretty solid. Nothing too special, but, you know, nice, hoppy, citrusy. So pretty standard, like, solid B+ IPA.
Awesome.
Yep, and that was probably, those are the two new things I tried this week. So definitely Ultra says if you find that, that was really good.
Yeah, that's everywhere out here, obviously. And honestly, like, not that it's the best goes I've ever had, but as far as like standardly available ones, it's definitely up there. Some things that I had in the last week, swung over to Monkish over in Torrance, had their Broken Barriers IPA. They've been brewing East Coast style IPAs and resulting in 7-hour lines outside on Saturdays. I went to the first couple of those before they were 7-hour lines. Now I don't bother. Can easily just show up on a Friday night and grab the beers on draft without a line. So I had that and Days of Underoos, both of which were very good IPAs. Had the brewery's Ride That Bear. It was a hoppy Imperial Brown. Was helping shipping some beer to a friend, so I got some stuff from the Midwest, including the Alberta Clipper Porter. It's a raspberry porter from Great Lakes Brewing. Had Unity from Three Weavers. Every year, a different brewery in LA brews with all the other members of the LA Brewers Guild a Unity beer, as they call it, for Beer Week. Beer Week's next week, so this year it was Three Weavers, which is over in Inglewood. And yeah, thought it was a pretty standard, Southern California IPA. I feel like LA IPAs are, we haven't developed our own specific taste yet, but we're starting to get there. Had the Patsy from Barley Forge, which is down in Orange County. It's a coconut milk stout. Very, very good. Had Hoppy Oro from Good Beer Company down here, and that was a kind of hoppy saison. And last night, I had a Day of the Dead from Threes Brewing out by you. Aaron Goldfarb sent me a couple cans of that. Threes just started canning some things, so that was much enjoyed. And again, the fact that I didn't have to wait on a 7-hour line for a hazier East Coast style IPA was much appreciated.
Yeah, 7 hours for a beer, as good as they can be, a little much.
Sort of dumb, because people were showing up at 5 a.m. for a noon release. And pre-gaming the noon release, which, no. Hard pass.
Nah.
definitely not about that. Again, you can show up and either that morning, you can literally just walk into the tap room and taste the beer, or you can even show up the night before without a line and all the hassle and nonsense. It's getting to be a bit much. So again, glad I Glad I got some East Coast hookups there. But yeah, why don't we move on to some Mountain West football, Dan?
Yay.
So, you know, there's an obvious favorite here. A team that usually out-recruits everybody else in the conference. The Boise State Broncos.
Yeah, coming off one of their weirdest years in recent memory.
The fact they lost in New Mexico is probably a good place to start.
That or the Utah State thing.
Yeah.
Which it was so weird that it's you almost have to look at it as like an anomaly. Where the New Mexico game was like more of like they lost a bad game. Like Utah State was like, okay, they just something happened. They didn't show up. They weren't ready. You know. Normal teams don't put up 52 points on pretty talented BYU or Boise State players.
Yeah, like last year was probably the first time in like modern Boise State, which I think like we're considering modern Boise State, what, like 2005 and beyond?
Like basically, I'd say like year of the that Fiesta Bowl and later.
07.
Maybe like Peterson era plus, like to now.
Yeah, I buy that.
Or even not, I mean, before Peterson, the guy who went to Colorado, Hawkins?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, somewhere in between there.
I buy that. But yeah, this was definitely the worst year, but it was a very strange, kind of convoluted year. And it didn't make any sense either to a lot of people because, you know, they completely blew out Arizona in that Fiesta Bowl the year before. Everyone was really high on them, saw them as the clear favorite to make a New Year's Six Bowl from the Group of Five leagues. And yeah, they didn't look the part. And I think offensively, you know, they delivered. But now you look at a defense for them that missing a lot of pieces from last year, which may be a good thing based on how bad the defense was. But that's kind of giving me a little bit of pause still, despite the fact that this offense should pretty much have everybody it needs.
Yeah, defensively, I look at the returning depth chart, and especially along the defensive line, and it makes me think, I've seen this issue before. It's called Syracuse 2015 to 2016.
Yeah.
They basically have no defensive tackles that have played at all. They have some nice defensive ends, which is good, but like the interior defensive line is totally green, which is an issue. Linebackers are pretty well stacked, and then their defensive backfield is also kind of shredded from the year before as well. So they're replacing, you know, some big pieces there. Offensively, as you said, they should be really good. They have Ripon, a quarterback who stepped in last year and was quite good. Actually, again, kind of a weird like Syracuse similarity. Soft freshman steps in, performs kind of above what you'd expect. Granted, he played a lot more. And then the running game was interesting, not super efficient, but just in terms of raw numbers, Jeremy McNichols put up some really, really good ones, you know, 13, 37 yards, 20 touchdowns. But they don't always get like a consistent running game. But they might have the best quarterback in the conference and a solid passing game. So it's going to be tough to like expect Boise State not to be a contender in that league this year.
Yeah, I completely agree. And, you know, like Ripien was, I think he was a 4-star. I know that he's the son of, is he the, yeah, he's the son of Mark Ripien, who won the Super Bowl with the Redskins back in the early 90s, you know, the last time the Redskins were relevant. But yeah, like, I'm pretty sure he was a 4-star. I mean, so he was somebody that came in with a lot of hype, and he just arrived much earlier than I think people were banking on. And now, yeah, he's head and shoulders above, you know, the nearest QB in the Mountain West, which, again, like, the fact that he's only a true sophomore, he should be able to, you know, improve on last year's numbers, which were already pretty impressive.
Yeah, like we said, he stepped in early in the year. He wound up with, I think, like 3,500 yards and a really nice touchdown interception ratio. So he should be one of the best players in that whole conference, and Boise State, you know, which has had good quarterback play in this entire era of, you know, Boise State being one of the best Group of Five teams. He might end up being, you know, as good as the Zabranskis and the other guys that have played that position for them. So
Kellen Moore
also a big name. I'm trying to look back. I'm looking at his 24/7 profile. I'm trying to figure out why he went to Boise State. He was a four-star player. But, you know, that's not usually the type of player they get. Like, they find, you know, more inefficiencies, and they take they have a little more academic leniency, which helps them with guys, and then they go get tweeners. And they have, like, a really specific strategy for how they get these really good teams. He was just, it seems like he was just a really nice get for them, and they beat out some big schools. They Mississippi State offered him. Looks like a couple of the Pac-12 schools were after him, so Washington State. So yeah, just a really nice get for them.
Yeah, I think you're going to start seeing more of this. I understand that you know, the gap between the Power 5 and Group of 5 programs has never been larger, but you know, the available talent has also never been a larger pool either. And I think if you put if you tell a lot of kids, you know, you can wait 2 years and potentially start at Mississippi State and be lucky if you finish fourth in the SEC West, or you can almost guarantee yourself that you're going to be drafted. You start for 3 or 4 years, you know, in the Mountain West or the American Athletic Conference or Conference USA, and you put up, you know, video game numbers. I feel like a lot more kids are going to start trending toward, you know, the latter versus the former.
Yeah, it's all about, like, what you value as a player. If you want to go and you want to put up wins and you want to go to, you know, have a chance to play in a big bowl game and after maybe an undefeated season, but not necessarily play for a national championship. And obviously Boise State has some advantages just because they're kind of a name now, so they're, you know, compared to your average really good Mountain West school, they are, you know, a team of interest. Versus, like you said, Mississippi State, you know, you can be Dak Prescott and you can get a lot of plaudits for being, you know, really, really good for 2.5-3 years, but not everyone can be Dak Prescott. And if you're just like an average Mississippi State quarterback or even just above average, you know, you still might only be winning 7 games a year at best. And that's, you know, that might be great. And if you're in the SEC, you're going to get a lot of exposure no matter what, but that might not be what everyone, you know, everyone's ideal is. So if Boise can keep on getting players like that, I mean, they have a really good shot at getting back to that national championship or, like, just bubbling under type of team they've had a couple times.
Completely agree. I guess now looking at a team that, you know, you and I and many others have said should be recruiting at the level Boise State is, San Diego State, arguably the only other really good team in the Mountain West, which is unfortunate. For this league, since it was supposed to be on par with the American Athletic Conference. SDSU surprised a lot of folks, just as I feel like, you know, they were one of those programs for a long time that people said, yeah, I mean, they should win 10 games because the Mountain West has its body bag games. They usually challenge themselves once in the out-of-conference. But then, you know, you look at the early part of the schedule for them last year. I mean, they visited Cal and Penn State, lost those handily. They lost a home game to South Alabama. That didn't help much. I know last year, I think they lost, well, 2 years ago, they lost to an FCS team. I think it was Eastern Illinois. The year before that, they lost another gimme game. So, like, that was becoming a hallmark of these Rocky Long teams. But, yeah, SDSU, after that loss to Penn State, just kind of put all the demons to bed. I mean, what they did to Cincinnati in that Hawaii Bowl was embarrassing for the Bearcats. It was just kind of sad to watch after a while, as you know, especially as I think fans of a team that used to play against and get kind of throttled by the Bearcats on a regular basis.
Yeah, I don't think Cincinnati would highlight from that game in their Big 12 portfolio. Yeah. No, like you said, they had the 3-game losing streak to start the year. They were 1-3, and then they just went on a crusade against the rest of the Mountain West. They're an interesting team. Their passing game just isn't much. They lose Maxwell Smith at quarterback, who just kind of got it done, but very much managed.
San Diego State has not had a real quarterbacking. I mean, and again, this is me speaking from a place of at least some knowledge with my connection via in-laws to the Aztecs. But yeah, San Diego State has not had the type of quarterback play that you would think you'd be able to attract pretty easily, given where the school is and where its campus is. But
and there's like a million Southern California quarterbacks every year.
And yet all of them end up going to Texas. Not Texas. Not the Longhorns, though. Other places. At least.
And the SEC is going after them now, too.
I mean, it kind of makes sense. There's a hell of a lot to like about the training out here. There's a lot of great programs out here. But yeah, I've never understood why San Diego State can't really upgrade itself from game manager. And I don't really know if Christian Chapman, the returning starter, well, not returning starter, but the kind of supposed starter, is really going to be able to change that. I think he can throw the ball. He did last year. I just hope that it's less game management, a little more playmaking on his end.
Yeah, I mean, luckily they have a gaudy running game. Donald Pumphrey returns. He ran for almost 1,700 yards last year and 17 touchdowns, and that's pretty much who they were. They had another 1,000-yard rusher as well. I'm sure this will be a similar attack, and they're just going to pound the ball and play really good D, and that is exactly who they are. I think your debate then at the top of the Mountain West is, do you like Boise, which might have more, probably more glaring holes, especially on defense, but they have the quarterback and they probably have way higher upside, versus San Diego State, which seems to be more secure in what it does?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it, to be honest. And you look at, I think the schedule this year, Cal isn't the test it was last year. There's no more Jared Goff. I don't think Sonny Dykes is long for that place. We've already played up some entertaining scenarios of what happens next there.
I'm not sure if you heard the full cast that went up today, but they were joking that when Texas goes to play Cal this year, Sonny Dykes might just like jump in one of Charlie Strong's bags and like have him take him back to the home state.
I did actually listen to that. I don't doubt the concept, because I see Cal's ceiling at about 5 wins this year, if only because the North Division is so tough in the Pac-12. But yeah, I think San Diego could test Cal, especially because of that. I mean, granted, there is no home field advantage at Qualcomm, but the fact they don't have to travel up to Berkeley is a plus. They have road games against Northern Illinois and South Alabama. Neither of those are easy, but I think that they're better than both programs. And then, yeah, you look down the list. They avoid Boise State yet again, and I don't see a loss in conference play. So San Diego State starts at a baseline of 9 wins if you include the New Hampshire game. That's one of the more advantageous roads of any team in the country.
Just because, and this is a total aside, but because I brought up Sonny Dykes, and it reminded me, because we were talking about him possibly filling in at Baylor, in college football this summer, why is it that every organization and school and league decided that it's going to be the summer of, hey, let's present a really bad idea to the public, and then the public is going to tell us how bad this idea is,
and walk it back,
and then we're going to retract it in like 3 days? Because that's happened 5 or 6 times this year at like all across like the scale of magnitudes, whether it's satellite camps, which is a really big story on an issue that's really small. Obviously, Art Briles, which was like a hilariously bad idea that I can't believe Baylor let get out. Even like LSU was going to ban other schools from doing halftime performances, and then there was an outcry, and LSU's like, oh, never mind. There's just like every time any school or league has presented an idea, A, it's been really bad, and then they're just really quick to button up as soon as the public reacts. Like, do people not... like, are there people in college football that, like, weigh the outside perspectives or how things are going to be reacted to before they actually go out and put them out there in public? Because it doesn't seem like it. It doesn't seem like anyone has any idea how college football fans will feel on things before they actually just go ahead and, like, put stuff out there. It's just crazy to me that it's happened so many times with, like, every conceivable issue in the sport. Hire Sonny Dykes at Baylor, just so you don't hire up Riles again. Because that was such an atrocious idea that apparently some Baylor people had that, you know, just don't do that. Hire anyone else, please.
Literally anyone. Except for Dino Babers. Don't hire him either.
Don't hire Dino Babers. Hire Brendan. They should have to hire Dred Robinson. I know we've joked about this with like a million programs.
Do it.
Dred Robinson, experience winning in the state of Texas.
True. Has a Super Bowl ring.
Has a Super Bowl ring. Has been a defensive coordinator with the Kansas City Chiefs. I don't think those teams were particularly good on defense, but he was there.
Understands how to cheat to get absolutely no advantage.
No, but not like the really bad kind of cheating like you were doing, which I don't even know if you call it cheating, because that almost makes it seem like it was like a game. It wasn't even cheating. It was like just horribly immoral bullshit. Like, is it like they didn't gain a real competitive advantage from it. They just don't have any morals as a university, apparently. So hire Greg Robinson. He's probably a nice guy from what we've heard. And that's a step up.
Yeah, and to be honest, like, to answer your question of how college football does this, I feel like it's most of the product of college football being run by, you know, older white men in their 65 to 75 range. You know, it's just a lot of guys who just feel at this point that they can't learn anything from anyone. And as a result, you know, this is kind of what you get, is that the public has become the test kitchen for them. They're like, hey, you know, I heard it worked for Bobby Flay, so let me get this test kitchen going. Let's just start throwing shit out to the public and see what they say about it. And at the end of the day, they already hate us, so we can just retract it in a couple of days if it doesn't work out.
It's like they use us all as like market testing.
Yeah, I don't know who gave them that advice. I'd advise them to walk that back as well, but I think we're too far down the road now.
Yeah. So anyway, San Diego State. They run and play good D.
Yeah. There's probably
sorry for the aside that just popped in my head.
That's fine. You know, I did say there were two good teams in the Mountain West, and I don't want to sell short another squad that could also be very good. Though I think that very good might more be based on wins and losses than actual quality, just because they're a service academy. They don't necessarily run a traditional offense. They just have a very weird program that is not bad. It just, they're oddly consistently good, and I would never call them like great ever. And I think that they're in for another one of those this year, mostly because their non-conference schedule is garbage, and at this point, I think the bottom half of the Mountain West is suddenly degraded into pure and utter trash.
Shout out to Air Force.
Yeah, shout out to Air Force, who, once again, the old triple option nonsense. They had to replace their QB. But again, Abilene Christian, Georgia State, Navy, which should be good, but not as good as last year without Keenan Reynolds. And
who Army.
Oh, an Army. And Army is almost a guaranteed win for Air Force, just because they're able to recruit, I feel, better athletes at Air Force. And same goes for Navy than Army has. I think Army's budget, I haven't really looked into this heavily, but pretty sure Army's got the lowest recruiting budget and the least athletic budget of the three service academies, which makes a lot of sense why Air Force and Navy are able to make it and succeed in you know, football conferences, while Army, their brief foray into Conference USA, I'd argue they're still probably reeling from.
Yeah, I mean, I think Air Force is interesting because last year they were kind of able to throw the ball a little bit, like more than your average service academy triple option team. Carson Roberts, you know, he threw for like 1,600 yards. He threw about 150 times. And they still have a nice receiver in Jalen Robinette, who, you know, as far as triple option receivers go, is pretty, you know, it's 640 yards. It's pretty good. Syracuse would take that compared to last year. The question is, do they become more one-dimensional now, like a standard triple option, or do they still have that kind of dynamic, a little bit more diverse attack? Obviously, the triple option gives people trouble no matter what. But the Air Force has had some of its better years recently. So the question is if they regress from there, or if they are still able to keep that up.
Man, you know, I've said this for years, like the triple option and for Georgia Tech, and they'll be the first to tell you it's not really a triple option there, but a spread option. An option attack works best when there is a downfield option. You look at the great Georgia Tech teams, you know, with Calvin Johnson and others, like, these were teams that had downfield options. You look at last year, how bad Georgia Tech was, and the year before, how good they were. The year before, you had Justin Thomas throwing the ball more. You had more downfield passing plays. The triple option doesn't work if every single play is exactly the same. It does work if you're going three wide every once in a while and you're catching defense stacking the box. And that's what I think Air Force understood last year. I think Georgia Tech got away from last year.
2 years ago, Georgia Tech was all about that, yeah, and they had, you know.
And they were 11-3, and they were a very, very good team.
Right. It's, yeah, I think just overall, without the quarterback and with some bigger questions, I they are definitely a run below. And with these option teams, you know, they, like we saw at Georgia Tech last year, you can have disaster strike. Obviously, Georgia Tech has generally been more like average until that 11-3 year, and then they fell way back last year. But sometimes just things, the chemistry doesn't work. Now, defensively, they actually return a decent amount, so they should be solid on that side of the ball, I think.
Yeah, and again, because the conference is trash, they'll probably be okay. Dan, so we don't go through all of these teams, because I doubt there's really much to say about a bunch of them. Who is your surprise team in the Mountain West? I know I don't think that any team is talented enough to knock off the Broncos or the Aztecs, but if you had to pick a team that maybe finishes second in their division without notice, who might that team be?
It's interesting. I'm looking at either Utah State or Colorado State. Colorado State, I'm just interested to see how they develop under Mike Bobo. Obviously, he was replacing Jim McElwain last year, and it seems like he was able to mostly keep things going. Obviously, they had a drop off without Derek Grayson, which was natural, and you know, losing their coach, you're obviously going to take a little bit of a step back. But I think there's a decent chance that he kind of bounces them back up, and they do have I think solid talent for that league. And then Utah State last year, not a great team, and then I think they are finally without Chucky Keaton for the half of season he would have played this year had he had a eighth year of eligibility, which is sad because Chucky Keaton was awesome when he was healthy, which he really wasn't at all last year.
Yep.
But Ken Myers, who stepped in for him, was quite good. I think, you know, a full year of him should be solid. He threw for about 1,600 yards, filling in for Keaton, who was hurt a lot of last year. 16 touchdowns, 3 interceptions, completed 50% of his passes. So pretty solid numbers for a young quarterback. And then they return a whole lot of runner, you know, a lot. They're basically their entire ground game for the most part outside of Keaton. And they obviously had that crazy win against Boise State, which, you know, I think they only ended up being 6-7 with the bowl game. But when you drop 52 points on Boise State, I think it says something about your ceiling, even if that was kind of a fluky game to begin with. And I feel like Utah State's just been very solid for a while, so. Those two teams are kind of bubbling under, I think. I don't expect one of them to beat Boise State in the Mountain Division. I actually didn't know what the divisions were called in this league until just now. They're very unimaginative. The Mountain and the West.
But at least it makes more sense than ours do.
Yes.
Because these are actual geographical identifiers.
They are. They really are. They put the Mountaineer teams in the Mountain, and they put the Western, the more Western teams in the West.
Yeah, that's
the West,
fine.
Which I guess is as good a reason as any to put teams in a division. And then I'd say shout out to UNLV, because I still think last year's coaching hire was interesting. Tony Sanchez, the high school coach. And I think we've talked about UNLV here before. They're going to take a while because they were coming from a really bad place, but there's a chance in like 2 years they have a lot of talent and are really interesting.
Yeah, UNLV is definitely my like long play here. And you look at the recruiting this past year, they finished fourth in the conference behind Boise, Colorado, and San Diego. So, yeah, I think you're looking at UNLV being a rising program in a couple years. And I like I said, we have talked about it. Sanchez is the guy for them, and I think that he was an inspired hire. And I also think if the Raiders happen to move to Las Vegas, I think that really does kind of fast-track UNLV in terms of the money flowing into that program. But for me, the surprise pick is going to be the Bob Davey All-Stars, the pride of Albuquerque, the New Mexico Lobos.
They went to a bowl last year.
They did.
And they played in their, was it in their home stadium? Because I think it was.
Yes, and they only lost to Arizona by 8.
Yes, a totally perplexing Arizona team.
I don't know anything
about
that.
Went to a Fiesta Bowl the year before and got destroyed by Boise State. But returned its quarterback, and everyone thought they would be pretty good because I knew Solomon was a freshman, and then he was a sophomore, and he was okay, but the rest of the team, not so much.
I don't understand Arizona. Rich Rod, if Arizona can't make a bowl this year, Rich Rod might get fired, and then it's all hell's going
to after he almost got poached by an SEC team.
Yes.
So, yeah. Rich Rod's going to like become like the he might just develop into like the sneaky like college football Jeff Fisher, where he is always just good enough not to get fired, and then he's just like always bad enough to actually like take his team to the next level. So they might have peaked. They might have peaked under Rich Rod already. He might, because I could also see Rich Rod just kind of playing out the string and coaching at Arizona for another 7 years, but never like really looked like he wants to retire. And they're like, "Hey, Rich, so what are you thinking?" He's like, "I'm good."
Yeah.
Well, what's maybe the, just turns into like Spurrier.
But what's the schedule? Like, I mean, I guess yeah, like in a similar Spurrier-ish territory. Like, what's the standard for success at Arizona? Like,
that's a question. Who knows?
Seven wins sounds pretty good for a state with no local talent.
A basketball school.
Basketball school that has to compete.
Which still has to compete against another in-state good team.
Right.
It's like a bizarre, it's tough because Arizona has like a little bit of talent, but not probably not enough to sustain two premier programs.
No.
Like it did for a year, a couple years ago, where I think they both had 10 wins. And then obviously everyone goes after California, which is starting to pick up, you know, especially quarterback-wise, schools from the SEC and Big Ten are starting to pick at the California kids as well, so it is kind of a precarious situation for the Arizona schools. And Rich Rod, I think he's a very good coach. Obviously, South Carolina went after him for a reason. They have some aspirations, but it doesn't seem like the ceiling is probably quite as high as Wildcat fans would want. But at least they have basketball, and at least that Sean Miller rumor to Pitt was hilariously stupid.
Yeah, I'm really glad that didn't happen. Also, here's a fun scenario, as we love to do coach switching. What if, like, 3 years from now, if neither side's happy, what if Todd Graham and Rich Rod just decide to switch places?
I mean, Todd Graham, Arizona is Todd Graham's family's, like, that's where they're from. And just because, like, I bet that he could convince, I bet he could have a dream where Tucson's a little better than
Tempe.
Tempe. Maybe like the dream, he almost got to the dream in Tempe, but it wasn't quite perfect. And then maybe Arizona State just like decides to like immediately buy out the oil futures that Arizona gave Rich Rod and then gives Rich Rod some better oil futures.
I mean, this seems plausible on a lot of different levels.
I hope that happens.
Coach trade, Arizona edition.
Oh god, we are definitely not done with Todd Graham moving schools. I refuse to believe that Arizona State is his final willing stop. Okay. And it doesn't seem like he's going to get fired. He's doing a good job, so I refuse to believe that Todd Graham is actually going to settle the Graham clan in Arizona forever. He's definitely got at least one more like weird move in him.
See you at USC in 2 years.
Oh, God, that'd be so good. I mean, that's 100% in play. That could absolutely happen. That's not even unrealistic.
No, that's why I said it, because I honestly think that that's in play. Like, if the boosters at USC get sick of it and decide they want to pay five coaches at once, they'll do it. And just like, hey, this guy Graham beat us once in the last 2 years. Screw it. Let's get him in here. Or maybe they'll just find that, like, one branch left of the Pete Carroll coaching tree that they haven't tapped into yet.
Maybe they'll hire Lane Kiffin again.
Bold.
Because the entire athletic department blacked out when they hired him the first time, and for that it happens.
No, just call Swanee in from the AD booth.
Now, you think he's actually going to attend games? He's going to be on the golf course. Like, that's there's true. No way he's going to be like an active athlete. Oh, I almost forgot they hired Lynn Swan to be their athletic director. What a ridiculous hire.
Man, you should have heard talk radio was fire out here.
I should have tuned in. How stupid. USC, no one squanders their lot in life like USC.
Nope, not a school. They also hired a search firm to help them hire Lynn Swan. Which, I don't think you guys needed to vet him.
Have you put in our paperwork to start our search firm LLC yet?
Not yet, but you know what?
I'm determined to retire as a college athletic search firm person. That is my dream job. I don't care where I do it from.
I mean, I feel like with the effort, it seems like it involves. You could probably do it from home.
I feel like I'm totally qualified to do that job right now.
Same. I think you and I...
I can come up with names for jobs. Like, I could have made a better hire than Lynn Swann or Clay Helen.
Well, I think most could. But looking at some of the other jobs around the country, there's certainly options as well. But yeah, I was going to talk about New Mexico, but I'm not going to do that. I will say that New Mexico has probably one of the best defenses in the league that is not at San Diego State, which could help them, especially considering there's like nobody back on offense. I would also point out before we go that, Dan, do you think Craig Bohl is going to get fired if Wyoming loses like 10 games again?
Man, I don't know. Like, Wyoming's such a ridiculous job.
Like, was Craig Bohl, like, obnoxious? Like, did he, like, think, like, oh, man, I'm going to do this? And then, like, it just didn't work?
I almost think he, like, flew a little too close to the sun taking the Wyoming job. I feel like I know that you had to be, like, a little inventive, but, like, wouldn't you think that a slightly better job would have taken a shot on him?
I mean, I feel like if he'd stuck around at North Dakota State for 2 more years, USC would have hired him.
Who knows? You never know USC's going to hire. Does he have connections to Terrell? I don't think he does.
Nope. So that right away is off the list.
It definitely wouldn't have. But like, I get wanting to stay in the same geographic region, and I guess that he had like ridiculous success at North Dakota State.
Wait for Minnesota. You could have gone to Minnesota this past if you really wanted to stay around there.
That's possible. Like, it just seems like Wyoming is not nearly the step up that I would have been comfortable taking from North Dakota State, where he was, you know, he was kind of god there. And I get it, it's 1AA, but I think that the gap between like the bottom of FBS and the top of FCS is kind of closing a little bit weirdly.
Yeah.
Like I don't think I don't think that you take North Dakota State over like a San Diego State or anything, but like Wyoming is almost like unwinnable situation. And why not just keep on winning 12 games a year? You'll get someone else's attention that's at least a little bit more manageable, where you have recruiting grounds and you have a population to draw from. Like, it's just, I didn't love that move for him. I thought it was a good hire for Wyoming. But with Wyoming, I don't know like that you can even afford to be that quick trigger. Like, if you fire him, who's going to take that job that's not, you know, the same type of person that's taking the Kansas job or the Hawaii job?
Yeah. Well, like, I'm looking now, like, he went to Nebraska, so he's not getting that job. He was never getting that job. Wyoming's paying him $800,000 a year, which I feel like is pretty lucrative for a Mountain West coach.
That's a ton, yeah. That's a big contract.
Yeah, so, like, I mean, I'm assuming his buyout's enormous, so he's there for at least another 2 years. I feel like Minnesota, Iowa State, like, these are all jobs. Like, he could have fallen right into the Iowa State or Minnesota jobs if he just hung around for another 2 years. They won those championships anyway. Craig Bohl, you could be the Cyclones coach right now. And instead, we're having a debate on a Syracuse podcast about whether or not you're going to get fired.
Yeah, if I'm Wyoming, I probably don't, just because I think if you're that school, I don't know that you can afford to have the reputation of a school that fires coaches too quickly. And it's not like he inherited a great situation, although they weren't like losing 10 games a year. They were losing like 7 when he took over.
Now they're awful.
And now they're really bad. So it's a bit perplexing. I can see both sides of it for sure. I can't say I've watched enough Wyoming to like really diagnose like where the issues are and whether or not they've been close or whether they're just getting like run off the field. But
no, they're getting run off the field.
Okay.
it's getting worse. It's not better. It's getting worse.
I think if you're Wyoming, I would trust the process of the hire and maybe give him 2 more years before you really make any quick things, just because I don't think there's an obvious way to... I don't know that there's an obvious direction. So I think as long as the on-field product looks better this year, they probably should hold on to him, even if it doesn't result in, like, a sits-win year or anything.
You know, I think they're a place that should definitely hire Clay Helton when he gets fired in 18 months. Just based on the circle of USC that's going on this podcast.
Oh, God.
Yeah. That's probably a good place to end, since we're coming up on, like, an hour and 10. As always, only got to about half the conference that we were talking about. Rambling included schools that, once again, were not in that conference, or Syracuse. And that's how we do things around here. Hope everybody enjoyed the show.
We've actually talked a lot of Syracuse the last couple of weeks, so nope. We were due for a mostly Syracuseless podcast.
A ramshackle sleigh of
so just so we get them in here, I'm going to now mention the schools we didn't talk about: Nevada, San Jose State, Fresno State, and I mentioned Hawaii, but I'll mention them again. So we touched on every school in the Mountain West.
Way to go, us!
We're very good at this.
Anyway, that was Dan. I'm John. Thanks everyone for tuning in to Troy Noon's An Absolute Podcast. Be sure to rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk, and we'll see you next week when we talk about the American Athletic Conference and Tulane.
Jordan Wave.